became something that he turned into a program called The Great Game of Business. And what he did is he helped everybody understand the finances of the organization on a very detailed basis and what each one of them could do to contribute to the financial success of the organization.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing SMB spend without buying an ERP, but we're not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Carl Baker from Baker CFO Advisory on the show, and I'll let you into a little secret. Carl and I had come up with a whole outline for this podcast, and just as we got to the end, you may be familiar that I asked people about Business Hero on the show, and Carl mentioned a book that actually instantly blew my mind. It's called The Great Game of Business. And we're going to chat about that today. And a guy from his hometown, as I understand it, called Jack Stack, who's come up with an alternative way to exiting your business, which is not an IPO. It's not bankruptcy. It's not selling it to someone else. But it's actually an option that, truth be told, is probably my preferred option. And we're going to chat about it today. If you have a business and you're interested in what's going to happen in 5, 10, 50 years when your business is no longer involving you, I think you should listen to this today. So, Carl, thanks, first of all, for coming on the show. And maybe you can open us up and by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Hello, James. Thank you. It's been great talking with you these past several minutes. And in our prep calls in the past, I feel like we have gotten to know each other pretty well. So I'm happy to be here, looking forward to the conversation. So you asked me what not many people know. And we've talked about this pretty extensively. I'm my neighborhood's cigar walker. So I live in a neighborhood with about 400 houses. And for probably 3 years here, I've been a cigar smoker for 20 years, but a few years ago I had this epiphany. I don't love exercising, but I've figured out how to do my level of exercise on a daily basis, which I go for a 4-mile walk. And at some point I had an epiphany that I could add a cigar to this. And so every morning, at least 5 days a week, I go on a 4-mile walk. I put my earbuds in my ear. I listen to some podcasts like this one. I listen to one of your recent podcasts this morning in my walk, and I grab an espresso, I grab a cigar, and I go on my walk. And I've become known for that in my neighborhood, in a silly way. People will honk at me, wave at me, or they'll even stop. I had one person recently stop me. She was passing me, yes, walking faster than me in the walk, and she stopped. We all said hello, and then she stopped, and she goes, "Carl, you're a legend. I've been watching you walk for 3 years, and I always chuckle when I see you walking by with your cigar, and I just think it's great, and just I'm glad to meet you." So little known fact there it's fun. It's silly. I roll my eyes, but it's fun.
Because it's not like you were averse to effort, right? You used to be a runner, running several times a week, and you had this idea you had to, if you weren't sweating, you weren't exercising. But did you say you're putting in more miles now that you're walking than you were running?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, these are not marathons. Like I said, I'm walking 4 miles a day, a little over 4 miles a day, 5 days a week. So I'm walking 20 miles a week. And the true serious exercisers are going to scoff at that as nothing, but it works for me. And I can do that the rest of my life. In my 20s, I was running 20s and early and 30s even, and some in my 40s, I was running periodically and I dreaded it. My knees hurt, my legs hurt, my feet hurt. And now I don't dread it. I look forward to it. And it's something that if I don't do it, I feel bad about it, and I love it a lot. So it's something I can do the rest of my life.
I'm totally with you. I used to be in the same camp thinking, well, if you're not sweating, you're not exercising. And then my habit, which I can share, which I want to give a shout out, I picked up, we did a podcast on atomic habits back in the early days of the show, and the guest introduced me to the idea of reward and habits. And what he did was he had a chocolate milk every time he went to the gym. And that sounds childish, but I said, let me try that. So now I have a chocolate milk every morning. So when it's cold and dark, and I don't want to get out of bed, I'm somehow that little childish reward at the end of the session calls me out, and I say, it's cold and dark, but I'm not crazy about the gym, but I can get a chocolate milk. So I'm in favor. I approve. And it's a cool little habit, I'd say.
It's a habit hack. That's a good way to say it. Yeah.
Your Based in Missouri, would you give people a bit of an idea on your pedigree and your background before we get into this book, just so we understand the level of expertise that you're bringing here? Tell us a little bit about where you were trained and where you came up and how you got your early expertise that's leading to your fractional CFO business, which you've been running for 7 years now, I believe, six or seven.
That's right, yeah. Sure, I was trained as a corporate auditor in public accounting. I did corporate auditing in Missouri and in Massachusetts, in Boston, Massachusetts, for 25 years in some of the larger firms. It wasn't the big four firms, but several of the other firms that are in the large firm lists. And I loved it. It was a great experience. It really helps. I'm a licensed CPA still, and I've been doing this for 32 years. But the public accounting gives you a great training in financial analysis, structure, learning how to deliver your expertise in a systemized, structured, professional way. And all of that is great. 7 years ago, I realized, though, that auditing, which is what I primarily did for healthcare enterprises and not-for-profit taxes enterprises, it wasn't the value-add set of services that I wanted to provide and what I had envisioned doing when I was a 20-year-old and getting my accounting degree in college. And a little shout out, I went to college at Truman State University in Kirksville, probably one of the best accounting programs in the country that you've never heard of, but it's a great school. It helps people pass the CPA exam pretty effectively, get you over that hump. I realized that we were providing a lot of compliance and auditing is necessary, but there's just not a lot of value add there. And I wanted to be helping people from a business advisory perspective, looking forward. So I took all those skill sets in my mid 40s, hung out a shingle, quit my job, started telling other accounting firms that I can help their clients operate better by being a fractional CFO for them. And I did that 7 years ago and left the corporate accounting field and started my own business, and that has led to where I am today.
Okay, so Carl, let me confess something to you. We talked before the call about how actually the great benefit of having a fractional CFO in my mind is you get to these questions that you feel too dumb to ask because everyone else seems to know the answer. And let me just get one of these questions off my chest while we're on the air here. I'm sure no one is listening, so it's fine. So because I've had 50 plus fractional CFOs on here, and many of them say public accounting, and I go, oh yeah, public accounting. Sure, I know what that means. So what is public accounting versus the other type? What does it mean when you say you're doing public accounting?
That's a great question. Many people, when I tell people I'm a CPA, let me ask you, what do you think many people think of when I say I'm a CPA?
Think of taxes. That's what I think of.
Yes, yes. So many people think, oh, you're a CPA. Can you do my tax return? The answer is no, I can't do your tax return. Could I? Probably. I don't want to. And it's not my training. So public accounting is a industry in which CPAs are pooled and they provide services to the public in terms of for the public good when other readers of the financial statements need to read financial reporting for businesses. That's really what public accounting is. So auditing is where an independent set of accountants are reviewing a set of financial statements and are verifying that the numbers are accurate so that third-party readers, bankers, investors can read the numbers and trust that the numbers are accurate and they can draw conclusions from them based on an understanding that the numbers are sound and accurate. That's really what public accounting does. The industry lumps in other things, tax and consulting, but the attestation aspect of public accounting is really providing the protection of the public interest for those that are reading financial statements of enterprises.
That's a great explanation. So when the public part is that it's not meant for internal business use necessarily, it's just for external, like the government is a part of that. Mm-hmm. Banks, investors, mm-hmm. might ask to see your accounts for whatever. Okay.
Yeah. Errors can be in a set of financial statements, whether those errors are unintentional or intentional. If it's an intentional error, that would be fraud. Unintentional could be from a lack of just honest mistakes. The purpose of an audit and an attestation engagement is to mitigate the risk of those errors being eliminated so that the third party reader can read the financial reporting and draw conclusions and then help the client in any way they're planning to do.
Okay, thanks for helping me there with my dumb question of the podcast. I can't guarantee it'll be the last
It's not a dumb question. People don't really understand what, if you're not in the business, you may not understand what auditing is and what public accounting is doing, but hopefully that helps. I did that for 25 years. There's a lot of compliance and it's a great way to build an expertise. And there is absolutely value in that service, but it's not the kind of value I wanted to be providing to the market when I got my accounting degree.
Sure. Okay. Now I talked at the top of the episode about the typical ways people think about exiting a business, whether it be the typical ones I'm thinking of is IPO, which is not going to happen to me for various reasons. Bankruptcy, which is entirely likely or possible that could happen to me. And then you've got the middle way, sideways motion, ebbs away, just gets closed down, et cetera, and other things. But you highlighted in your hero and your one of the books you mentioned a third way, which I've been fascinated with. And I thought it's just for the big boys. So maybe you could introduce us a bit to your concept here.
Sure. You usually ask that question at the end, but you prepped me and said you were going to ask me that. And I thought about it. And I mentioned to you that a gentleman who's pretty world famous, I have to admit, I've never met him, but he lives in my community. I'm in Southwest Missouri, Springfield, Missouri. He lives in this community. His name is Jack Stack. And he became famous for being the general manager of a company here called Springfield Remanufacturing Corporation, SRC. And it wasn't for purposes of helping that enterprise exit the market or to exit ownership. Hmm. The purpose of the concepts that he infused into the business was to improve the finances of the business. It was struggling financially. And what he did is he implemented an ESOP, an employee stock ownership program, which is for some people, and it's not for everybody, but he implemented an employee stock ownership program where he made all the owners, he made all the employees owners of the business. That's one thing. But more importantly, he implemented a system that he developed while he was navigating through this. It became something that he turned into a program called the Great Game of Business. And what he did is he helped everybody understand from the CEO down to in the world of corporate hierarchy, a vertical hierarchy. He helped everybody understand the financial statements of the organization, the finances of the organization on a very detailed basis, and what each one of them could do to contribute to the financial success of the organization. And then that created an enterprise that just exploded into a top-notch corporate enterprise. And in terms of exiting, if you are a sole proprietor owner or an investor group owner and you want to get out of the business, an ESOP might be the way, but more specifically, applying that great game of business into a program that adds improved profitability through down the line employee transparency about how each one of them can contribute to the financial success of the business, it will just pay huge dividends internally or externally.
So I love this concept because I have, maybe it's my Catholic upbringing, but I've innate guilt at being the owner of a business versus, you know, there is what has happened in my business, and I have to admit it, there's a them and us sort of ethos which can arise. The owners, people with equity ownership, and people who have a job in the business. And it's very ironic that because I didn't want to have a job, and yet I've created dozens of the bloody things for other people. And right. I always have a bit of, and I feel like when you talk about having your team aligned, this is an inherent contradiction between the outcomes for the beneficial owner of the business, the equity owner, versus what the team has. So I'm on fire about this idea. I love this idea of getting everyone aligned the right way. Let me just ask a few questions here, because this is something that was very common early in my career in tech, right? So ESOP, employee share ownership, and it was got a bit of a bad name, I would say, in a tech company when I was coming up, where you would come into a company, a startup typically. And that's what I would be afraid of doing too, is like saying, okay, we have an ESOP, I'm going to start issuing shares to people. And then I would feel like, now I feel like am I being honest with everyone? Because unless I decide to sell, or we decide to sell, it doesn't really matter. Or does it fit in with profit we decide never to sell, then how does he recommend, let's put it this way, I'm not phrasing this very well, how does it fit with profit share? Does it fit with profit share and the ownership part of it, or can it just be profit share without the equity part? What does he recommend?
No, absolutely. It fits with profit share, ownership. There are different ways to structure it, and I think it depends on your goals. But the real benefit is you are two things. You're giving them some incentive to contribute, for each person to contribute in their role in the most effective way. If you do that without training, there's a lack of insight and a lack of transparency about what that really means. So they still might just trudge along. The most important piece of that is to also train them to understand the financial drivers of the business. And once you buy this book and read it, you'll see that they trained on a very detailed basis in understanding the P&L on a line-by-line basis. How many paper clips are we buying, and how important, how does that drive the business? How they all understood revenue recognition. They understood gross profit and what are the drivers for each of those pieces, the timeliness of decision-making. He taught everybody in the business to understand those drivers, and they talked about it on a weekly basis in a weekly huddle. They had a multi-page financial statement, and everybody understood their role in it, and they understood everybody else's role in terms of being able to read a P&L statement.
And how did that extend to things like compensation? Is it open book in terms of what people are getting paid? Because that seems like a hot topic.
Yeah. I think they managed to work around that so that not everybody knew everybody's compensation, but in some fashion, yes, they understood it. I don't know that they knew exactly what, for example, what Jack Stack's W-2 looked like per se, but they certainly understood compensation at a certain level. If they have the right attitude and they understand how their piece plays into it and they're seeing financial benefits from it that go beyond their $20 or $30 per hour compensation, then it helps.
Yeah, I can see how. Now, I guess thinking about this, I mean, this is something we already do for sales teams. It's quite common. It's easier for sales teams to build a comp plan. Everyone expects sales teams to be well paid because we know there's risk associated with that role, and it's just in the culture. The below the line costs, you know, the overhead costs, it gets a lot murkier to try and draw a line between this programmer here or this success person here, having a direct line on how they're impacting the business. Be trickier. Did he come across that in the book, or what is it only suited to certain types of business where it's really easy to break everything out and see how everyone's contributing?
No, I don't think this is meant for any one specific type of business and exclusive to those businesses. I talk to my tax exempt clients about it. I talk to everybody about it because, again, the benefits of it include providing insights to how everybody's role contribute to the success of the business. If I am in a, just to use another example, that was a quasi manufacturing enterprise. But if I take that concept and I apply it to a large multi-specialty physician practice, the person at the front desk, if they have the kinds of insights being taught in this program, The Great Game of Business, the receptionist at the front desk, they understand how their role contributes to the success of the business. They understand they need to collect copays. They understand how that contributes. If I collect the copay when the patient walks in the door today, then they don't have to chase those monies 90 days from now. They can collect most of it today. And they may not understand that. If you just tell the receptionist, collect the copay today, and they don't understand how that really contributes, they might shrug and say, well, if I don't get it, I forgot, I didn't collect it, we'll get it in 90 days. If they understand how that impacts their business, and how it eventually impacts their compensation and their own financial well-being, then they understand that in a much more insightful way. And that makes their job more important than just showing up at 8 o'clock and getting through the day.
Yeah, this shows up in my business sometimes in that, for example, let's say we're decision-making. We're trying to make a decision on a particular feature to build or something to do. And oftentimes the decision, quote unquote, at the end of the meeting is we need more information, or let's think about this, or let's go and get it or stuff. And all the time we're talking about it, I'm thinking the clock is ticking here. Like, we're all getting paid hour by hour. The longer it takes us costs to make this decision, the more expensive it is. But that's invisible to most employees, in fairness. I mean, a lot of owners don't really think about it that way. But that is actually the case. The longer it takes you to make the decision, the more costly it is.
Yeah.
Therefore, the more trouble you're in. Sounds like that you really need, you need to know your stuff. So was Jack Stack, is he an accountant? Was he able to, how was he able to implement it? Because it sounds quite high level.
To be clear, this was something he developed in the 80s, and then it evolved. He didn't wake up one morning and come to Springfield Remanufacturing Corporation and bring this. What he did, he was a young general manager. I think he moved from Chicago to Springfield. This was a branch location, I think, and it was a struggling enterprise. It wasn't doing well, and they asked him to turn it around. And he tried to figure out how to do it, and he figured out the only way to do this is to help everybody understand and get everybody on board with what he wanted to do. If I'm coming in as a dictator and telling everybody, then I've got to slash and burn constantly and slam down the hammer. Or if I bring everybody along and I incentivize them, and it's going to be a much more conducive environment to success. And he navigated this over the years. But trust me when I say he brought a lot of transparency into the business. Again, the employees were looking at a very detailed line item by line item basis on the P&L. And you mentioned decision making. There are case studies that say if a company is always waiting until they have 100% of the information in order to make a decision, you're going to lose tons of money. You need to figure out a way, and I'm not preaching to you, but a business owner needs to figure out how to make a decision with 60 or 70% of the information available, wrong or not. Learning to make that decision with not all the information is the way to advance a business more effectively.
Yeah. I was reading this morning a tweet about how Europe is now something like 75% of the size of GDP in terms of the US. 16 years ago, they were at parity. There's a lot of, you could debate forever why that has happened. But my personal experience of working with US companies is they make, the speed of decision making is definitely got to be a factor there. My personal experience, like a European, typical European or Irish company, in a month might make three decisions. Two of them will have turned out to be correct, which is good, 60% hit rate. But in that same time, a US company will have made 10 decisions, only four of which would have been correct. Not so worried about it, but like just moving it as you go. Say that's only a 40% hit rate, but net, they've made one extra good decision to business along. And if someone had to put a gun to my head and say, why is America doing so well at the moment? It's that culture of building a parachute on the way down, which maybe you sometimes experience then when you're brought in as a fractional CFO and where you're talking with customers. So maybe we'll talk about that a little bit now. Like when you're brought into like an organization, what stage are they typically at, and what are the typical challenges you have to face?
Yeah, so when I come into a business, I have worked with startup enterprises, but usually my ideal client is one in which they have developed their value proposition. They have established a place in the market. They have gathered a following. They have a customer base, but many times they have a small investor group or a sole proprietorship, a sole owner. And that owner or that leadership group, they're wearing all the hats and they've learned how to find their customers. But the owner is wearing all the hats. They're wearing the hiring hat, the sales hat, the marketing hat, the financing hat, talking with bankers, pleading for money, whatever. They're wearing all these hats, but they're trying, they're having some success, but they're trying to scale. Or they're trying to add new services. They're looking for financing so they can grow. They're trying to add a new location, whatever. And if they're in that sort of growth mode or change mode, at some point they need to start leveraging the hats so that they can scale at a quicker pace. It might seem outrageous to a young business owner to let somebody else look at their bank statements, to look at their compensation, to look at their accounting records, to get insights into their proprietary marketing and sales processes. But at some point, a scaling business leverages all of that so that the business owner can be the visionary. And what we do is we come in, that business owner may not understand what that multi-layered business looks like. What does it look like to have somebody managing the books, managing the bank statements, managing the bank accounts and all of that? What does that look like? We know what that looks like. They're at point A or B. They're trying to get to Z, and they don't have a clue what that looks like. And so we come in and we start building those building blocks to get them from B to C to D to G to whatever. And just building that set of processes and providing some clarity. Frankly, it'll provide peace of mind because there's usually some chaos there. And so that just, you can see it as you start working with them, the peace of mind and the clarity that you're providing to a business owner.
Businesses, and listen, the prototypical visionary type, sometimes very scatty, just full of energy, amazing people, like they manage to sometimes these businesses can get to fairly significant scale on the back of a napkin sometimes, or even a spreadsheet maybe. And it's a magical partnership then where you're able to bring in the structure around that. The trick is we don't know. It's hard to tell at the early stages the difference between scatty disorganization that's going to turn into something big and scatty disorganization, which is going to do what you would expect it to do. Like I have friends who are apparently insane on the outside and yet they're building incredible businesses and knowing that. So what are the telltale signs where you're saying, listen, if some of you're listening to this, you've had success, maybe you're up to 6-7 figures in income, things seem to be going well, but you're hit a ceiling. What are the telltale signs that it's time to start looking for a fractional CFO?
I would say a few things, but the telltale signs include chaos beyond manageability. You might start getting turned down by banks. You're most likely going to need to, in order to scale, you're most likely going to need to access working capital, some sort of debt in order to grow the business. Certainly there are businesses that are bootstrapping, but still, when managing cash flow, if you're wanting to grow and scale beyond 2-3%, you're going to need some access to working capital. If you're going to banks and you're expecting banks to just loan you money based on your wonderful story, you're probably going to be surprised and you're going to start getting declined. And so you start hitting these barriers, and those barriers are signs that you need to add some structure to the business. I had one enterprise, that's exactly what happened. They were growing. The bank told them your financial statements don't even exist because your existing accountant hasn't given you any financial reporting for 6 months. So we're not able to give you a loan, but you're trying to grow. And so financial leadership will help, and I'll stop talking here in a second, but it is also important to understand as they see that, they need to be willing to be coachable and to have the corporate will to allow that infusion of financial leadership to help.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. And then the number one, maybe not one complaint I hear from fractional CFOs is, or need, let's say, is how can I scale my business? And the second complaint or need I hear is how can I get rid of the clients who don't listen to me? So it's almost as bad as not having them at all. If you're giving that advice and they're not coachable, it's like anyone else, it's going to be hard to, and it's a pity because it's really an unlock. If you can find that fractional CFO that vibes with you, much a personality fit thing, like a work together, then it can explode your business in a good way.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's my experience. That's my vision of it anyway. What do you feel like there's a duo? I'm trying to think of the right word, like a duo, like it's a key partnership. It's a key relationship that can make a business go a lot faster.
There's some rapport that needs to happen and some trust that needs to be built. And some of that comes when they say, yes, I'll hire you. And yet they may not allow you to make all the changes that the fractional CFO can see from the numbers. But give it some time. I'm working with a client now where I saw at the very beginning that there needs to be some changes. I didn't know exactly what those changes were needing to be because I didn't have the institutional knowledge, but I could see that there was something that needed to happen. So we came in and just slowly built some rapport, built some training, built some trust. And over time, we started introducing the concepts of change that needed to happen. And once that trust was there, I could say that in a way that wasn't offensive to them, and light bulbs start going on, and then change starts to happen. I see that all the time.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your own practice and how you've developed it now. What have you found to be success? What do you do in terms of marketing, growing, finding customers, and what has been successful for you in the past to be able to acquire customers?
Yeah, so I started with reaching out to my referral source network, my professional colleagues, bankers and accounting firms, frankly. The accounting firms that we talked about at the beginning of the show, they have clients and view their audience auditors as their trusted advisors. But because of the nature of that service, like we talked about at the beginning of the show, there's an independent relationship. There's only so much that auditor can do to help the client and provide services for them. They have the skill set to provide other services, but if they're going to be the auditor, they have to maintain this independence line. So they can't come in and be a CFO for the client. But they usually are the first call that an enterprise makes when they're talking with them about a need for financial leadership. So I talk with accounting firms about your clients. I'm not trying to steal the work you want, but you have clients that are struggling and you can see what those struggles are. And we could go down the line of what all those struggles look like, but let me help your client base improve and everybody will benefit from that. So that's number one. I do a lot of just education, talking with clients, raising awareness about the struggles that we've seen, and maybe that will turn a light bulb on. And then some just one-on-one networking. I'm not a big cold caller. I don't do a lot of cold calling, and I just try to add value to people that I meet and just try to help people and do it from a servant's heart to the best that I can.
Okay. Step one in building a successful fractional CFO firm, do an awesome job for 20 years with a great reputation.
Yeah, that's it. Network.
Yeah. Okay. That's easy. We got that in the bag.
Right.
But you're not just sitting back. Yeah. I understand you've launched a podcast as well, or a YouTube channel where people can find out more of the education you're spreading.
Yeah. Again, I love teaching and helping people that way. There's an appetite for education out there. We think that we get our education from schools, and to an extent we do, but real life education happens on the job every day. And especially with the explosion of technology, we have such access to information now. And I'm just trying to do my little part to raise awareness about things that business owners can do to add some structure into their business, some financial thought and wisdom into their business. We do have some real estate videos, some real estate podcasts. That is Infinite Returns, Commercial Real Estate Investing. You can see some podcasts there. And then honestly, I've translated that into a YouTube channel called Take Command of Your Business, Let's Talk Finances. And we put videos in there and educational videos to help people to understand how to talk about accounting and financial reporting to help people with their businesses.
Great. How can people reach out to you if they'd like to, more directly, if they'd like to get in touch?
Sure. You can. The best way is to go to our website, bakercfoadvisory.com. On there is our phone number, email address. My email is Carl, K-A-R-L, at bakercfoadvisory.com. You can reach out to me there. Phone numbers are on the website, and you can get to know me a little bit there. Also on LinkedIn, you can look me up on LinkedIn, W. Carl Baker, and you can find my activity there and my resume and the sort.
Great. Thanks, Carl. And thank you for listening to the Gross Profit Podcast. I have to say, I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I really learned something new on this one. And my free consultancy, my cunning plan to bleed expertise out of people I'd normally have to pay to get it is coming out nicely for me, although I'm sure Carl would do it for me anyway.
Sure.
So if you are still listening, then your special bonus offering is to be able to go to procurementexpress.com/partners. On there, I've recorded a webinar having interviewed more than 50 fractional CFOs now. Some, like Carl, are very good at explaining their value. Others are frankly terrible at it. And I think if fractional CFO is the most powerful hire you can make in your business over a certain level of revenue, say 2 to 10 million, none of people are doing it. But the reason they're not doing it is because most of those fractional CFOs are not properly explaining the value, in my humble opinion. So in that webinar, I've put together how I would explain the value of a fractional CFO to a CEO, which I am. And I think, I hope if you have a business like that, you might find value from that. I've also included a case study with Ben de la Creta. He's one of our best partners. He uses procurementexpress.com when he onboards biotech companies to be able to get control on their spend without them having to spend tens of thousands of dollars on an ERP. There's a double whammy there for you. I hope you get some value from it. That's it. Yeah. Carl, thank you very much for being on the show. This has been an awesome one.
I've had a great time, James. Thanks very much. I'm going to check out your website you just talked about too, the webinar.
Yeah, do. I recommend procurementexpress.com/partners. There we are.
Very good.
See ya.
All right. Thanks.